அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் எங்களது இனிய காலை வணக்கங்கள். இன்று லைஃப் டிவைன் வெப் மீட்டிங் தொடங்க இருக்கிறது. ஸ்ரீ அன்னை பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் அப்பா தவ திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதார விந்தங்களை பணிந்து இந்த நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். இன்றைய டாபிக் எக்ஸ்க்ளூசிவ் கான்சன்ட்ரேஷன் ஆஃப் கான்சியஸ்னஸ் ஃபோர்ஸ் அண்ட் தி இக்னரன்ஸ். மிஸ்டர் கேரி அவர்கள் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். Now I am inviting Mr. Gary to start the speech.
Good morning. The American novelist Mark Twain, maybe some of you have read his works. Appa has been referring recently to his novel called The Prince and the Pauper. I don't know whether it's come in the published writings yet, but it'll be coming in future because he's been reading it and talking about it quite a lot. The story, for those of you who don't know it, it's a story about the son of King Henry VIII, the son's, he's the Prince of Wales, his name is Edward. He's a young boy of maybe 13 or 14 who's being groomed for the throne, for the next king. There is a boy who's growing up in poverty in the city of London, who looks very similar to him. He's growing up in a very poor house, but due to the help of a priest, of a clergyman, this young boy, whose name is Tom, is taught and educated, learns Greek and Latin, and gets an education, but he's from a very poor family. He has no clothes, no food, or anything. By a very interesting set of circumstances, the two of them meet, and the prince takes him into the palace, into his apartment. They look and realize they look very similar. The prince changes clothes with him, and by accident, not by design, he's mistaken to be the pauper, Tom, and thrown out of the palace. And Tom is mistaken to be Prince Edward. And the story is how both of them, Tom is all the time claiming he's not the king, the prince, and Edward is all the time claiming he's not a pauper, he's really the prince and heir to the throne, and the adventures they go through. The interesting, very interesting story, but one of the most interesting things about this, Edward gets into so much of trouble because wherever he goes, if people treat him like a poor boy, which is what everybody regards him, even his own father thinks he's really the pauper, he's really Tom, he keeps protesting and say, how can you treat me that way? Don't you know I'm the Prince of Wales? I'm the future king of the country. And of course, the more he claims it, the more they laugh at him. His father hits him and abuses him and calls him a useless boy. And he gets into so much of trouble. A series of trouble. He gets caught by a gang of thieves. He gets imprisoned on accusations that he's stealing, so many things. But each time, in spite of the situation, some life situation comes and saves him. Some help comes to him, especially from a poor nobleman named Miles Hendon. Until finally, at the end of the story, the mix-up is revealed and he's restored, and by that time his father has died and he becomes the king. The experiences he had, it was not just a bad experience. It was a tremendous education for him, because as the future prince, he's grown up in a cloistered environment inside the palace. He never knew what life was like. He never knew what the people were suffering. He never knew what was being done in the name of the monarch by the petty officials, how much injustice, how much punishment was being meted out to people who... So he learns a tremendous amount through these experiences. All the time he's trying to escape them, but during that time he gets a very precious knowledge, so that when he becomes king, he becomes a very wise and benevolent king who changes the laws very radically, because he knows how unjust they are. He knows how people are being punished for no fault of their own. And therefore he's loved and admired by the people for being a just king. He never would have done that if he hadn't gone through this experience. This is a story in which the prince knows that he's a prince, but nobody believes it. The ignorance is the way the world is treating him. But suppose we rewrite the story. And the prince himself, maybe he gets knocked on the head and he gets amnesia. And the prince himself doesn't really know he's the prince. And he goes through all of these experiences, not understanding why he's going through them, not understanding why life comes and saves him at the last minute and always seems to come to the rescue, not understanding what the purpose of any of this is. But then when he regains his memory, he suddenly realizes that he has gotten an invaluable experience that makes him a better person and helps him evolve and be a better king. Our situation is like that. We're all princes or princesses meant for the throne. We're all getting pushed around by life in so many different ways. Nobody listens to us. Nobody understands how important we are. Nobody understands how special we are. But somehow life somehow always seems to come around to the rescue at the last minute and save us from the worst difficulty, and things get better and all. Only thing is, we haven't woken up from our amnesia yet, and we don't know why any of this is happening, because we're in the ignorance. All religions and philosophies have tried to understand why this ignorance is here. We've been talking about it for the last 12 meetings, 13. This is the 13th meeting on the ignorance. Book 2, Part 1. The infinite consciousness and the ignorance. And we've been exploring this topic of ignorance. Maybe you thought after the first or second, third chapter, we've said we know everything there is to know about ignorance. After all, we're experts in it. We live in it all the time. But he keeps telling us more and more, more shades of the truth about this ignorance. And in the last chapter, The Origin of the Ignorance, which we discussed last month, he made a firm statement. Forget whatever the tradition says. Forget whatever any tradition says. This ignorance is not a mistake. This ignorance is not the result of some power that's fighting against the divine. This is not the work of a devil, as though it can be very devilish at times, no doubt. Ignorance is not, the divine is not ignorant. The absolute is not ignorant. Brahman is not ignorant. Ignorance is a power. It serves a purpose. And he told us last time that the nature of the, and he's been telling us all the time, all over, the nature of reality, the real reality, not the way we perceive it. The real reality is Satchitananda. It's an infinite existence, an infinite consciousness, an infinite bliss. And anything else other than that, meaning all that we're experiencing, is not the real nature of reality. It's an ignorance. We are not destined to suffer for the rest of our lives or for the rest of all lives. We're not living in an illusion. We're not caught in a universe from which we need to escape. Everything has been created by the divine, by the supreme, for a purpose, including the ignorance. The absolute is not only a pure infinite being, it is also the becoming. It's also the manifestation. It's also the universe. Brahman is not just that unity, that oneness that we can go into through moksha. Brahman is also the multiplicity. And there is nothing other than Brahman. There is nothing other than Brahman. Brahman is the one and the many. Brahman is not just some passive state of trance. Brahman is the whole active movement of the universe with all its change, with all its speed. But he also tells us there's nothing other than Brahman, but he also says ignorance is not a characteristic of Brahman. Brahman is not ignorant about anything. Brahman has not forgotten anything. Brahman has not made any mistakes. There's nothing that can come in and spoil the show that Brahman has designed in creating this universe. Ignorance, if it exists, and it does exist, must only be a power of Brahman. And obviously a power of an infinite consciousness and an infinite wisdom cannot be an error or a mistake. It must have been a power serving a purpose. And Appa has always appreciated that sentence in Life Divine where he says, ignorance is a greater power than knowledge. Always baffled me. But in reading this chapter, for the first time, I really began to get a glimpse of the genius, the miracle that the ignorance is. It's not just a miracle that the infinite consciousness can become ignorant, but for me, the essence of this chapter, which I really learned something this time in studying it, is how the ignorance is helping a miracle of divine life unfold in the universe. He gives us a vision of it. I hope we can get some glimpse of it today. He says ignorance is not just, it's not the character of Brahman. Ignorance is not even the character of our own soul. The native truth and existence of our own soul is only in the knowledge. It's only in the light. So even for us, ignorance is a state that our soul takes on for a purpose. And our task is not only to understand that purpose and understand how we got into this ignorance and what purpose it serves, but most importantly, how do we get out of it? How do we learn from it? What should we learn from it? How do we emerge from it? He told us at the end of the last chapter that the source of the ignorance, if ignorance is not there in the Supreme, if ignorance is not the characteristic of Brahman, ignorance is certainly not there in supermind, because supermind is the truth consciousness. There is nothing but knowledge in supermind. Knowledge, power, bliss, capacity. There is nothing missing. Supermind is the whole resplendent manifestation of divinity, not only in its oneness, but in its multitude. if it's not in any of these things, where does it come? And he told us at the end of the last chapter, ignorance comes from mind. Mind is a subordinate power of supermind, he has told us much earlier. Mind is that which divides the one into many. And ignorance comes, even in supermind, the one has become the many. But in mind, that differentiation of the one into many, like the white light passing through the prism becomes a rainbow of colors. In supermind, we know they're all parts of one. They're all aspects of the same light. But when it comes into mind, all the colors seem to be totally independent of one another and seem to even be clashing with each other, and they forget their origin. Mind is that in which the many are cut off from the one. And because they're cut off from the one, they also get cut off from each other. Because the link between all of us is not our marriage relationships and all that's on the surface. The real link that makes us is the oneness inside. And in the mind, that link with the oneness is cut off, so we feel separate from the divine. We feel separate from each other. We feel separate from the world around us. And that's the nature of the ignorance, which we've been discussing in the last few chapters. Mind divides us from one another. It divides the inner from the outer. So when I think of myself, I think of what's inside my skin or inside my head and my heart, and everything else is not self. That's mind. That's not reality. So now, how is that ignorance created by the mind? And if ignorance is really a power of Brahman, though Brahman is never ignorant, and we shouldn't get that confusion there, how does it create it? And he says, ignorance is created by the capacity for exclusive concentration. Ignorance is the result of a power of the divine for exclusive concentration. What does it mean, exclusive concentration? It means we have the capacity, mind has the capacity to concentrate on one thing and push everything else out of the way. Hopefully, now while we're talking about life divine, you and me both, all of us, are thinking about life divine. We're not thinking about what happened yesterday or what's going to happen tomorrow. We're not thinking about the dinner tonight or the shopping tomorrow or the marriage next week. We're thinking here. We have a capacity. Doesn't mean we've become ignorant. It doesn't mean we've forgotten all these things. But we have a capacity to focus on something and get so absorbed in it that at least for all appearances, this is the only thing that exists for us at the moment. This is a capacity for exclusive concentration, which we all know because we all do it all the time. And if we didn't have that power, we'd be in big trouble. No student could study for an prepare for an exam. No mother could deal with the demands of a newborn baby. No man and woman could interact in a harmonious way if we can't even listen to the other person, which we know it's difficult enough to do that because we want them to listen to us. If we can't focus on what we're doing at the moment, if when we're driving we're talking and thinking about something else and don't watch where we're going, all our accomplishments come because we're capable of concentrating on one thing to the exclusion of everything else. It also turns out that all our problems come from that. That's another thing, and we'll come to it. So we understand what exclusive concentration is. Concentration is a power of consciousness. Something without which the universe couldn't exist, because it is by that power, the infinite. Remember, this, we're the creation of the infinite consciousness. How does the infinite consciousness create finite things? It has to concentrate on them. How does Jane Austen create a story like Pride and Prejudice with this magnificent detail and life and wisdom in every incident, in every small thing? Because even though she's written many stories, and she's not confined to her stories, she has a whole life beyond the stories. We don't know Jane Austen's life, her own romances, her own dreams, her own family. We only know what she's putting in the story. She had the capacity to concentrate on Darcy and Elizabeth and what he's going to say to her and what she's going to react and how he's going to feel and what he's going to do. And that's the power of manifestation. So if Brahman didn't have this power for concentration, we wouldn't be here. Because each of our souls is a concentration of the infinite of Brahman to bring out certain qualities of that infinite and manifest them. And if any of you or I or anybody tries to manifest all the qualities of Brahman, the only color we'll get is white. There'll be no color. Color comes because, actually, as a physical thing I'm saying, scientifically, color comes because some of the colors are held back and only some of the wavelengths are shown. In physics, if a piece of cloth is black, everybody knows if something is black, it absorbs all the heat. Don't wear black out in the hot weather because you'll be boiling even more. Wear white because it reflects all the light. Why do we see a white cloth as white? Because the color white doesn't absorb any of the colors of the light. It reflects them all. So we see white. If we have a black cloth, what we think is, it's because all of the wavelengths of light are absorbed. Nothing is reflected. And if it's blue or green or whatever else is the color, it's because some of the wavelengths are absorbed and some are reflected. So each soul you can think of is a color of the rainbow, a special, unique color or combination of colors in which something is being absorbed, something is being reflected, and by what? By some power of concentration. We reflect something, we hold back something. So all creation is involved with a reflecting something and holding back something, absorbing something. So this power of concentration, which is a power of Brahman, Satchitananda, supermind, mind, there are several types of concentration. There is a concentration in which Brahman concentrates solely on itself, on its essence. For us, the closest we can come maybe is meditation, where we get lost in contemplating the deepest feelings in ourself, and we forget the rest of the world and everybody else, and we forget yesterday and tomorrow and everything. It's an essential concentration. We try to concentrate on the essence. That's what we do when we try to meditate on Mother. We try to concentrate on what is the essence of Mother's consciousness, the peace, the sweetness, the love, the strength, the light. It's an essential concentration. There's also a concentration in which we try to concentrate on many things and see them in their totality. Every housewife has to do that because she's got to think of the children, she's got to think of the husband, she's got to think of the shopping and the preparation of the meals and the cleaning of the house. You have to concentrate on lots of things simultaneously and put them all, somehow keep them together. And if you're working also, then there's much more to concentrate on than that. It's a concentration on multiple things, and that's what most of us try to do, though we forget a lot of things, and our concentration is still very narrowly confined. We're usually concentrating on ourselves and our family, not the neighbors, not the country, not the rest of the world. But this capacity, we have not only a capacity for an essential concentration, we have a capacity to concentrate on multiple things. We have a capacity, the supermind has the capacity for an integral concentration, where we can concentrate on everything, the essence, the multiplicity, and everything in its relationship, so nothing is lost. Everything is connected with everything else. We don't have that, so we can only understand that it exists. But that's a form, that's the supramental concentration. And then there's what he calls the separative concentration, which is what we normally are. We concentrate on ourselves, not the rest of the world. We're constantly thinking of ourselves. Okay, ourselves. Sometimes some of us have ourselves as a little bigger. We ourselves includes our children, or ourselves includes our immediate family, or the articles in our house and our utensils and clothes and things like that. But we tend to concentrate on a very narrow part. For us, the rest of the world rarely exists except when we see something on the TV or read it in the newspaper. Even if in our extended family, if the family's big, how often do we think about our distant relatives and the people in North India and the history and the future and all? It's a narrow, single, separative concentration. Each of these is a different form of concentration. The exclusive concentration, which is the one we're talking about now, the concentration of the ignorance, is a concentration in which we focus on one thing to the exclusion of everything else. So much so that it doesn't exist for us. At least for the moment in which we're doing it. When we're in coma, or rather when we're in, if we lose our memory, we can't concentrate on the past, we don't remember it. We're not thinking of the future because we're all the time trying to figure out where we are and what we're doing at this moment. It's an exclusive concentration. But eventually, even in this story, if the prince has lost his memory, he regains it at the end, in my version of the story. So all that was not really lost. It was not that he was really ignorant of who he was and all the things he had forgotten. It's just he was in a concentration on the surface in which he forgot those things. We are like that. We are living on the surface, in the moment, thinking that we're each confined to a narrow situation, to a body or whatever it is. We don't remember our past. We don't remember our past lives. We don't know about future lives. We're not identified with everybody else. But it's only on the surface. It's not true for our soul. Our soul has a knowledge which we don't have. Our soul is not ignorant. So our soul has put forth this exclusive concentration, just the way we're trying to do today to talk about life divine. We're trying to be absorbed in the discussion on life divine and for a purpose. For a purpose. And we have to understand what that purpose is. So what is the nature of our exclusive concentration? He says it has two basic characteristics. First is we're exclusively concentrated on the surface. He uses the example of a stream and the sea. The stream flows into the sea or it flows out of the sea. The stream is a tiny little narrow movement. The stream is a movement in time. The sea doesn't seem to move. It's just a huge, infinitely large body that's there. But the stream flows because of the pressure of the water in the sea. If the stream is flowing out of the sea, it's because of the stillness of the sea. The stream is not independent of the sea. All the water for the stream comes from the sea. But this stream is a little tiny trickling movement, like when we open the tap and the water from the tank upstairs comes down in a little trickle. That's the stream. The sea is the water in the tank. This stream is our superficial consciousness. That's what we live in. That's what we think of ourselves. We don't see the sea. We just see this tiny little trickling stream, and we think that's us. What is our stream made of? Our stream is made of thoughts, which are constantly coming in the mind, feelings and emotions that we're constantly feeling in the surface, sensations that we're feeling with our body. And that's what we think of ourselves. And if I ask you how you are, say, I'm feeling very fine today. I'm feeling relaxed. I'm happy. I've had my lunch. My mind is quiet. All we're talking about when we say that is the surface. We're not talking about our real being. We're simply describing the stream. Stream is flowing nicely today. No impediments there, no big wind, no obstruction, no heavy waves, no disturbance. It's a nice flowing stream. But how are you? We don't know that because we don't know the sea. We are exclusively concentrating on the stream. Nothing wrong with having a stream. But when we mistake and think the stream is everything, and we live only in the stream, and we miss the fact that the stream is a tiny little trickle of the ocean, and especially if the stream begins to dry up, and, oh, my stream is drying up, I'm going to disappear. How can you disappear? You're an infinite ocean. This stream, if you simply unclog the connection from the ocean will create a flood. You're worried about the stream. You have a whole ocean. You're worried about water supply. Where's the question of water supply? You are an infinite body of water, but you're narrowly focused on the stream, and you forget the ocean, which is yourself, which is your real being, which is reality. Think about Jane Austen. Jane Austen is the sea for our purposes. She's a creative consciousness. What can she create? She can create anything she wants. She can create any story she wants, any number of characters, any number of novel situations she wants. And each is itself a universe, as she's created Pride and Prejudice, which to us looks like a universe in itself. She's the sea. She creates a character named Elizabeth Bennet, who is a tiny little stream on that sea. And an actress named Jennifer Ailey is asked to play the part of Elizabeth Bennet. Well, Jennifer, in order to play that part, like you or I, if we had to play that part, we have to put behind us all the rest of our personality and forget the fact that she may have played so many other parts in the past and maybe in the future, and she has so many other things to do. Acting is only part of her life. She's a daughter or a wife or a mother or a friend and a cousin or a neighbor, whatever else it is. And she has to concentrate on being Elizabeth Bennet. Compare Jane Austen with the actress. The actress is only identified with one character in the story. Compared to that, Jane Austen really is an ocean, and the actor, Jennifer, is a small part, a stream. But even compare the part of Elizabeth with the life of Jennifer, and Jennifer's act as an actress, she's got a much wider life, but she concentrates on playing the part of Elizabeth Bennet. And then look at it from Elizabeth Bennet's point of view. She has absolutely no idea that there's an actress called Jennifer Ailey who's playing a part. She has no conception that there's a writer named Jane Austen who's written not only this story, but so many other stories. She's really lost in the stream. And for her, the only thing that exists is the stream. And if you start telling her that this is a part of a story and the person who wrote this story has written so many other stories and there are so many other stories beyond that, it's not real to her. That is the nature of our exclusive concentration. We each think we are Elizabeth Bennet or Jane Bennet or whichever Bennet you want to be, or Charlotte or Carolyn or Lady Carol. I leave the choice to you. We all think we're that, when in truth, the truth of our consciousness is Jane Austen. We're the sea. That's our exclusive concentration on the surface. And it's not just an analogy. That's really the truth. Our surface is that tiny little dot, and our being is an infinite ocean by comparison. We have another type of concentration. We're not only concentrated on the surface, we're also concentrated in the moment. We live one moment at a time. We discussed this in earlier chapters about how we live one moment at a time, and to us, the past no longer exists. The future doesn't exist yet. We try to recover the past in memory. We try to imagine the future, think about how it might be in imagination. But the truth is, the past is never over. The past is always there. The past lives in the present, because everything we are today has been a result of that past. Everything we know. I couldn't be speaking language if I didn't have a past. I'm thinking of living in the moment, but where did I learn the words? Where did I get the ideas? I wouldn't know you if I was only living in the past, if I only living in the present. We bring the whole of the past with us into the present at each moment. Though we only see the present, the whole past is there. Behind. That's the true principle, he says, of karma. Our idea of karma is some superstition or some vague idea. Karma is not punishment for past acts or anything. Karma is simply the principle that the whole past is always there. And the consequences in the present are a result of that past. And therefore, Mother says, if you want to change the present, you change the past, which we can do through consecration. Because it's always, how can you change the past? It's over. I made a mistake. I did a foolish thing. And now I'm living with those consequences. What can I do? It's over. It's there. It's not here. No, it's here. It's always here. Because the past is always present. And we have the same problem with the future, because for us, the future doesn't exist yet. You're asking me the ending of a story that I haven't read yet. How do I know the ending? But the future is determined by the present. The future is, the whole future is there in our present, in our consciousness, in our aspirations, in our expectations. We see in this story how the whole future, the whole end of the story, everything is there in Mrs. Bennet's aspiration. For all that we joke about her or find fault with her, and she gives us a lot of scope for that, the truth of the matter is that it's Mrs. Bennet's aspiration that drives the whole fulfillment in the story. And if only she had kept quiet, of course it would have been a very short story, because everything would have been settled much earlier. So we're happy that she interfered and gave us some entertainment. But the power of the drive was all there in the fact She wants to marry 5 daughters. The future outcome is determined in the end. And if you think about life divine, what's the first chapter of life divine? Huh? The human aspiration. And what does he say there? He says that since time immemorial, since the earliest human life, man has aspired for light, freedom, immortality, bliss. And what does he say is the end of the story? Divine life. We say divine life, it's all a theory. It sounds nice, but how do we know whether it will ever come and all? It doesn't look very encouraging when we look today. He says the end of the story is already there. It's not only now there now. It's been there from the beginning. It's the aspiration that reflects what's going to happen in the ultimate outcome. So, but that's not how we live. We are lost in a moment. Oh, I feel all alone here. I don't know what happened in the past anymore. I don't know what's going to happen. It's all a mystery. It's all a bit scary. It's all happening without my control. Because we live on the surface. We don't live in our immortal being. We are not only unconscious of what's happened to us in our earlier life or what's going to happen in our later in this life. We don't know. We're wondering all the time. We don't know. We're unconscious of all the past lives we've had. How many hundreds, thousands, I have no idea. But for us, that doesn't exist anymore. But he says, no. The whole of our past evolution from wherever we started, and I don't know whether it's true that we started and went from frogs and goats and all of that or not. We'll just worry about the human part of it. All of that is there because what the soul has acquired from those past births is here now, is where we are now, is why we are here now. And all our future destiny is also here now. Why? Because the very birth of our soul, the creation of our soul out of Brahman, is an embodiment of certain qualities of Brahman that want to manifest themselves. Each of us is a color or a group of colors of the rainbow of the divine, which is trying to manifest itself through an evolution through many births. So our future destiny is also there. The whole future is also there in the hidden aspirations, not for marriage and job and money and things like that, but in the aspiration of our soul for the divine. Because our aspiration is to discover our own divinity. That's our future. So this is the exclusive concentration that has created our ignorance. We're concentrated on the surface, and we're concentrated at the moment in time. But, he says, it's very important that we understand that what's really determining the outcome in our life is what's behind. It's the sea that's pushing the water and creating the flow of the stream. It's not our decisions at every minute. It's the aspiration deep in our soul that is creating the circumstances of our birth and the circumstances of our life, not the thoughts and feelings and actions on the surface alone. The real determinant at all times is in the depths of our being, or rather, it's in the divine. It is the supermind that is determining, just like it's not Darcy and Elizabeth who are really determining the action in the story. It's Jane Austen. It's Jane Austen who knows the future, who knows where it's going, who knows the end of the story, and creates all the circumstances for that to happen. So we're concentrated on the surface. But the real action, the real creation, the real determinator of our actions is in the depths. And those depths are not ignorant. We're ignorant on the surface. When we read the story, we don't know what's going to happen. But Jane Austen knows the whole story. Our soul, the divine, knows the whole thing from beginning to end and where it's going and why everything is the way it is. So our ignorance comes because we're exclusively concentrated on the surface. Of course, that raises a question, why? Why do we get concentrated on this ignorance? Why should we be ignorant when our soul is not, and when Brahman knows everything? Why shouldn't we enjoy that too? And that, to me, is the secret of this chapter. To understand why the ignorance is created and what function it serves. And I don't think anyone has ever written about it or understood it before Sri Aurobindo. And I've read the book many times and I have not understood it as much as I do now, even a month ago. So it's a precious knowledge. Think about the characters in the story. Mr. Collins is raised by an uneducated father who's relatively poor. He's a backward person, somewhat a strict disciplinarian. Somehow or other, his son, not very intelligent, not well cultured, not well bred, but you can say he's good intentioned, he's ambitious, he gets an education. Somehow he begins to rise in life. He finds a benefactor or patroness in Lady Catherine. He knows he has some distant relatives he's never met, the Bennets, who are respectable, educated, prosperous. And now he makes the contact with them with a benevolent motive that, after all, I'm going to get the entail, and it feels cruel if I take away the property from the five girls, so why don't I marry in the family? It's a nice gesture. But what happens when he goes there? He thinks that he's gotten it. He compares himself with his father. Compared with his father, he's educated. He went to Oxford or Cambridge or whatever it is. Compared with his father, who was a poor farmer, he's a clergyman. He's got a job with 800, 900 pounds a year. That's a very good income for him, five times or 10 times what Wickham is earning. He's got a patroness. He has tea and dines with Lady Catherine. He has connections and all. He's very proud of what he is. But how does it seem to the Bennets? All they see is he's the son of a rustic, uneducated man who still has all the trappings of a rural person. He tries to behave nicely, but if nothing comes out right, it's all odd. And Mr. Bennet has fun with him by asking him to explain how he comes with such nice flattering comments. And foolishly, not knowing that Bennet is laughing at him, Collins explains how he creates these little flattering comments so that he can use them. And he's very proud. He thinks that he's being admired for his capacity to flatter, when actually Mr. Bennet is enjoying, amusing, but making fun of him. Now, just imagine. That is, Collins is ignorant. Whatever he has done, he's ignorant. And maybe fortunate that he's ignorant. If he really knows what everybody is thinking of him, he won't be in that house for a minute. He'll run away. He'll go back to the village where he can talk to his father, because at least with his father he can say, I know more than you. I got education. Listen to me. What can he do here? He actually goes into the Netherfield ball and starts talking to everybody as if he's an equal. The only one who thinks he's an equal is him. He goes up to Darcy and wants to introduce himself. You see, I know your aunt. I saw her just last week. Darcy turns his back. He starts talking about, if I had played music, I think I would have done a good job. He's talking like Lady Catherine and making a speech in the ball. And everybody's feeling embarrassed and or laughing at him or thinking he's foolish, but he doesn't know it. Well, imagine if he knew it, if he knew what everybody was thinking at that time. He won't be able to do this. This ignorance protects him. After all, it's not his fault that his father was uneducated. It's not his fault that he hasn't learned the modern manners and culture. Of course, he need not be unnecessarily proud and vain, but he knows what he knows. But if he had all the knowledge that they have, he couldn't go out in the world and develop at all. He couldn't achieve anything. So that ignorance is a protection for him so he can develop something. In 1978, when Chrysler Corporation was on the verge of bankruptcy, Lee Iacocca, who had been the president of Ford Motors, accepted the job as the president of Chrysler. And he said, if he had known how bad the situation was, he never would have taken the job. He said he was literally seeing double. He was crying when he saw how bad the situation was, how miserable it was, how the lack of discipline, the lack of organization, the chaos and confusion everywhere. He never would have taken the job. Because he took that job, he became one of the most famous men in America, and he could have run for president. Whether he would have won or not, I don't know. But he could have run for president. He became so famous. He became a household name. So if he had had that knowledge, he never would have made this effort and grown in his personality and achieved so much. So his ignorance served a purpose in allowing him to develop courage, in allowing him to develop his capacities and do things he never knew he could do. Of course, after he did it, he doesn't say that I never would have taken the job. After he completed it, he says, yes, I took the job, I did it, and we've succeeded, and now I'm a famous man, and very rich man also. Afterwards, he doesn't say, I'm sorry, I took the job. But during that time, he really believes, when it's going on, I never would have taken the job if I'd known what I was getting into. So the ignorance enables him to attempt things he wouldn't have attempted, to discover capacities he wouldn't have discovered if it hadn't been there. One of the things that makes this story so great is Darcy discovers deeper inner values. He discovers what it is to be really good, unselfish, and even to love. But we know in the story, the only reason he discovers this is because he's so arrogant, so feeling so self-important and so superior that he goes and proposes to a girl who's not in love with him at all, rather who dislikes him and almost hates him, and does it in such a clumsy way that he makes her abuse him. And if it hadn't been that he was so arrogant, so proud, so pompously self-important, she never would have abused him. Not only has nobody ever spoken to him that way, but it's for sure that Elizabeth never spoke to anybody in her life that way. She's not somebody, see, when Lady Catherine came and spoke all those unpardonable things, Lizzie never abused Lady Catherine. She simply refused to accept what she said. She's not one who wants to go and abuse and find fault with people by nature. She was provoked by Darcy. Darcy's ignorance, pride, was a necessary condition for him to get the response from Elizabeth that would help him discover the depths and greatness of his own inner personality. It's a mystery. the thing we feel is bad. Oh, that man is so ignorant, or this man is so proud, and we abuse other people. We accuse them all the time, not realizing even their ignorance serves a purpose for their soul, for its evolution. We're only thinking about ourselves. If only that person would appreciate me or be reasonable and understand my point of view. So there's a mystery here. There's a secret here. Even that which we condemn in other people, even when we rightfully condemn, even if we vote and we're all condemned, we have missed the point. Their ignorance serves a purpose in their evolution, otherwise it won't be there. So what an understanding, how far we have to go in our understanding. And of course, when we're aware of our own weaknesses, we feel very sorry for them. Oh, why was I born this way? Yes, yes, I got that from my father, I got that from my mother, I did this or that or something like that. I'm unlucky. Why do we have this characteristic? I'm not saying it's a great thing we should hold on to. Our progress comes from giving up the ignorance. Don't mistake me. I'm not saying that the ignorance is the gems and the crown jewels in our case that we should cherish and protect. The ignorance is the thing we should overcome, because all our progress, all the real gems come out only when we shed the ignorance. I'm saying, though, the fact that we have ignorance is not a mistake, it's not a curse, it is a condition for our evolution. And if we understand why those conditions are there, or where they came from, or what purpose they serve, we can also know how to overcome them. And of course, in the last chapter, Sri Aurobindo gives us the secret to that whole thing. It's very easy to shed the ignorance as soon as we decide to give up our taste for the ignorance. Our ignorance is only there because we're enjoying it. That's the truth. Our ignorance serves a purpose until we realize that the ignorance we're enjoying is much less than the joy we'll get from knowledge. And then we discover more. But this is a mystery. It's not a mystery without an answer. It's a mystery that can be solved, that we can get the answer. But it means, especially I think in looking at other people and all, we should be much more respectful of how this characteristic of ignorance in other people, we need not justify our own, but at least we should try to understand the role that that characteristic plays in another person's life. Not to support it, not to encourage it, but at least not to feel superior by condemning it. So, we said that exclusive concentration is the source of the ignorance, and the fundamental ignorance we have is we're ignorant, we live on the surface, we're ignorant of our true being, and we live in the moment, we're ignorant of the eternal time, in which is where we really live. That's not the only kind of exclusive concentration we have. I already gave you the example of when we're talking about life divine now. We each concentrate on the ideas, on the subject matter, on the relevance for us, and we put other things out of the way. Just like Jennifer Ely, when she plays Elizabeth Bennet in the movie, she concentrates on being Elizabeth Bennet. But it's not like she totally forgets who she really is. It's a temporary thing. She goes and plays the part. She plays the scene, they film it, and then she goes back to being who she normally is. But in this particular case, we know, we've heard, that both Jennifer and Colin Firth, who played Darcy, actually concentrated so hard on being the parts they were playing in the movie that they fell in love with each other, and for about 6 months, Jennifer really said she felt like Elizabeth. That's She actually thought that she was not Elizabeth Bennet by name, but she took on the personality of Elizabeth, and obviously Colin Firth also thought she was Elizabeth, fell in love with her, and 6 months later they woke up and realized it was only the parts they were playing, not their real self. We normally, when we're talking about life divine now, who knows what we'll be thinking of 3 hours from now? It'd be wonderful if we still are thinking of it, but I doubt very much it will still be in the foremost in our mind. So we have a temporary capacity for exclusive concentration. The difference is, if we want to stop talking about life divine right now and talk about different ways to make sambar, I'm sure we could have an interesting conversation, except I have to listen to you because I don't know anything on that subject. We can switch. A problem with our ignorance is being concentrated on the surface, being concentrated in the minute, I can't suddenly go back and be aware of my soul. I don't have that power to switch back and forth the way I do on the subject matter between life divine and sambar or some other subject. We are all very good at that. So there seems to be a similarity in this capacity for exclusive concentration, but also a difference. It's not fundamentally a difference. It's not essentially a difference. It's a difference in degree. Because even when I'm talking about sambar, or even when I'm talking about life divine, I know there are a lot of other things I could be talking about and thinking about, which I'm interested in, which I'm keeping back. But I'm absorbed in this. Even when we are on the surface, lost in the moment, lost in our superficial self, wondering why am I Charlotte and not Elizabeth? Or Wickham saying, why was I born as Wickham and not Darcy? Behind his soul, all the time knows that he's an infinite being. So essentially, it's the same movement. We also have a capacity for even a more absorbed concentration, which Aurobindo has mentioned, a complete self-forgetfulness in an act. We can get so carried away by an act that we're not even aware of that we're absorbed in it. At least I know we're talking about life divine now, and I'm thinking that I'm talking about life divine now. But it's possible we can get so absorbed in what we're doing that we don't even remember that we're doing it. And Sri Aurobindo says the warrior in the midst of a battle, when he's preparing for the battle, he knows what he's doing. But when he's facing the opponent and life is at stake, and in the next minute he has to move this way or that way or do this or that to save his life and to win, he forgets everything. He's carried away by the passion of the moment. And when we get angry, we can get so absorbed in our anger we literally forget ourselves. This too is only another form of exclusive concentration. So the difference is only a matter of degree. I think when N.T. Rama Rao was making movies, he played the part of Rama and so many heroes and everything, and he stopped. He never woke up fully from that absorption, and afterwards he really believed that he was those people and got elected, because many people also thought that he was really the character he was playing. So we have all these variations from, I'm sorry, I lost my head, I don't know what got into me, for a minute I forgot myself, to for 6 months, Jennifer thought she was Elizabeth, and NTR may have thought he was Rama for half of his life. And we, who go through a whole life, not just one, but a whole series of them, thinking we're this little dot or stream when we're really the ocean. But fundamentally, it's the same power. It's a power for exclusive concentration. And he goes one step further and he says, this thing we call matter, this stone, that earth, this physical body, that gold chain, this thing we call matter, and is also only another form, a deeper form of exclusive concentration. This also is Brahman. This is the spirit, so absorbed in the form that it doesn't show any signs of being anything else. And the whole material universe, which seems to us to be the opposite of spirit, the opposite of divine, and so opposite that nobody has ever conceived of the world becoming divine. Nobody's ever conceived that life could be divine. Life can be divine up in heaven, some loka up there. But the idea that life could be divine here on earth in a physical body, that the body could be divine, the body could be immortal, is inconceivable unless you understand that this is also a trance of self-absorption of the divine. And that it's light, it's freedom, it's immortality, it's all of the spiritual principles self-absorbed. Not in the trance of moksha, but in the other trance, in a dark trance, where it forgets to manifest any of its qualities. So the whole creation of the universe, not just our ignorance, the whole creation of the universe was made possible by an exclusive concentration of Brahman, of spirit, to appear as matter. And that too has a purpose. It's not a mistake, it's not an error, it's not a miscalculation of the divine when it was manna creating a universe. It has a purpose, just like our ignorance, for the purpose of a manifestation. And he tells us in this chapter what that purpose is, why we are ignorant, why the world, why the inconscient is there, why there is ignorance in the universe. The first thing he says is, ignorance is necessary for the manifestation of this world. He says it doesn't mean you could not have a world without ignorance. You could have. After all, the supramental is a world, is worlds are there. But this world that we live in could not exist without ignorance. You can have color, as I said. You can have a white color, but you can't have red, blue, green, yellow, and orange unless you're going to hold something back. If you're going to show everything at once, you're going to only have white. We're going to all be wearing the same color and all looking the same color. If you want variety, you have to hold something back. So, infinity cannot manifest itself without self-concealment. If we all talk at once, we won't understand anything. If I try to speak everything in my mind at once, it'll be gibberish. Unless we hold back, we can't have a conversation if we're both talking at once. We tried it often and we know it doesn't work very well. Only our capacity to hold back makes possible an orderly manifestation. The infinite has a lot more to hold back than we do. You know, when somebody else is talking and you want to tell them something and you're waiting for them to finish, you know how difficult it is because you have this one thing you must say. Imagine if you had an infinite number of things that were pressing to be spoken at the next minute. How difficult it would be? That's the problem the infinite has. It wants to manifest infinity. Infinite power, infinite joy, infinite knowledge, infinite creativity all at once, and it's has to hold itself back in order to do it in an orderly way. Otherwise, we'd have chaos. We won't have this world anyway. He not only says that ignorance is necessary, he specifically says that ignorance of the past and the future is necessary for this world to exist. People have often said, many people have said from different countries in different times, that life would have no meaning if we knew the end at the beginning. If you knew the end of the story of Darcy and Elizabeth at the beginning, after all, Darcy and Elizabeth meet and got married and lived happily forever after. Nobody will read the story. The truth is, Darcy and Elizabeth never would have gotten married if they had known, the thing that made them get married was a process. The thing they fell in love with. Darcy at the end of the story is not that much more lovable than Darcy at the beginning of the story. I don't know whether you'll agree with me. Elizabeth at the end of the story is the same Elizabeth that he's called tolerable. What's really admirable about Darcy is the change he went through. What we really admire Darcy for is not that he's the perfect man. Maybe he is for some of you, I don't know. But I don't think of him that way. But I think of the courage that he had and the sincerity he had to change and transform himself. That's really admirable. Well, if we know the end and the beginning, there can be no story of transformation. There can be no story of evolution. There can be no experience of change because you know everything. It's like a joke in which you start by telling the punchline and then you tell the joke. Who's going to laugh at the joke if you already know the punchline? The whole value is it creates a suspense and then you solve it by telling the punchline at the end. So this world that we live in, this universe, which is an evolving universe, in which we get most of our joy comes from the surprises, from the endings, from how things turn out, the problem that becomes an opportunity, the insurmountable difficulty. My case is that the really thing, the real reason that Darcy passionately loves Elizabeth, he wanted to marry Elizabeth at Hunsford. He was not deeply in love with her. He was attracted to her. But after she told him, "You're the last man on earth I would ever marry," she became the most desirable person in the universe for him. Why? Because nobody has ever considered him last man. And if he's able to marry her, what does it say? It means the last man has become the first man. I have mentioned this story earlier from Anthony Trollope, a short novel called Rachel Ray. A simple novel. A boy comes to a small town in Germany. He sees a very beautiful, young, innocent girl, very pretty girl, but a simple, innocent girl. And he finds her very attractive. And he sets up a company and a business in the town, and he goes through all different difficulties in the town, and the people are talking against him and so many things. And finally, at the end of the story, he gets up the courage and he goes to Rachel and he says, "I love you. Will you marry me?" And she said, "Since the first time I saw you, I wanted to marry you." And suddenly he feels disappointed. He thought he would have to really court her and persuade her and hope that someday she would accept him. And now she says all this time, which he's been thinking about her and wanting her, all this time she wanted to marry him even in the beginning. Oh, that was too easy. Maybe I have chosen the wrong person. Because he wants to choose he thought he's choosing the best and the highest that he could reach. The truth is, if she had said, "Well, I never thought about it before, but I can't say yes. I won't say no. Let me see in future. He would have gone up in his estimation. When Darcy proposed to Elizabeth at Hunsford, he took for granted he knew the answer. Like Collins, he almost didn't pause for the answer. I'm announcing we're getting married. Now he only has to tell her the date. He was shocked. Like Collins, they were both shocked when she said no. Collins couldn't believe his ears. Maybe you haven't understood me. Don't you realize you may never get another proposal? Darcy was bewildered. And when he prods her and finds out, the truth is, from the first month I met you, I decided your selfishness, your arrogance, your pride, you're the last man I would ever marry. Suddenly she rises sky high in his estimation. Because he took for granted any girl wants to marry him because he's got 10,000 pounds. He's a tall, pretty handsome man. He's got status. And he took for granted that she's one of the many. Suddenly she announces, I'm not one of the many. You want to? You marry Charlotte or Jane or anybody else. Don't think I'm one of the many. I'm not one of the many. Just for your money, I won't marry you. Just for your status, I won't marry you. Even if you're tall and handsome, I won't marry you. I don't like you. So it became a challenge for him. So if at the beginning he knows, when he walks into the dance the first time and she sees him and she's introduced to him and she says to him, Mr. Darcy, it's very nice to meet you. If you ever decide to propose to me, the answer is yes. Finished. All the progress that he has to make in the world and all the joy of discovery, and if you see the movie, it's in the book also, the same way in the book. Darcy never smiles in the whole story. He never laughs. He's never even happy until he proposes to her the second time at Longbourn. And when she says yes, he just gives this beaming smile. Oh, the wooden man can actually smile. And in the book, she describes it beautifully, how filled with joy he is at that moment. That joy wouldn't have been there if she had accepted him at Hunsford, and certainly wouldn't have been there if she'd announced in the first dance that if you propose, I'll say yes. He would have been sad. He would have been sorry. He would have been irritated, like Collins trying to introduce him. Who are you to think that I would propose to you? You're just tolerable. So this process of self-ignorance in time, it's not just a question of we go through in a drama and adventure and finally it sorts out all right. We learn something. We grow. We progress. We create something. We become something different because of this ignorance in time. And that's what the evolution is. That's why the divine has created a universe in which it starts as matter and mud and then becomes ferns and moss and bacteria, and then becomes plants, and then becomes animals, and finally begins to speak and think and dress and do the things that we do, so that it can have the progressive adventure and the creative joy of discovering at each step more and more of its hidden capacities. And that could never be there if it wasn't a world of ignorance. You could have, he says, a typal world. And there are typal worlds. Sri Aurobindo says the gods live, are typal beings. They don't evolve. They don't have psychic beings. They're the same from beginning, the same till the end. They behave the same way. They never change. They consider themselves perfect. But Mother says human being is greater than the gods because God is stuck where it is, whereas not greater than God, greater than the gods, because the individual can discover itself as the infinite. The God is not the infinite. The gods are not the infinite. The gods are fixed portions and types like colors of the rainbow. They cannot discover the white light and still manifest different colors. The human being is potentially, the soul is greater than the type of beings of God. So the purpose of the universe is for infinite divine to manifest itself infinitely. And that's not just a question of an infinite number of colors or shapes or forms or beings or what. It's also the infinity includes a capacity for infinite change, for infinite self-discovery, for infinite mysteries and secrets that unfold themselves, for the infinite joy of acquiring new capacities. So this is an infinity. It's not just that Jane Austen can write novels with hundreds or thousands of characters, but each of these characters can change and interact and learn and be different and have experiences. And this would not be possible if it weren't for the ignorance. There are about 100,000 types of flowers in the world. Imagine if there were only one type. Imagine if all flowers were the same. We'd be very sorry for what we have lost. It may be very beautiful. It may be available in thousands or millions. It may have a wonderful fragrance at all. But the variety, the endless variety, and no two roses are exactly the same, even among the roses. So it's the same with us. Why did God create, why are we so imperfect human beings? Imagine if we had the capacity, I don't know how we would do it, to describe the perfect human being. Or if a novelist like Jane Austen could describe the perfect man. Or if you want the perfect man and the perfect woman. And every story, it's the same man and the same woman. If there are more men and women, they're all the same. The wonder and glory of the creation and the mystery and divinity of it is when you take people who are very different and they interact with each other, you get a creative situation which something is created that doesn't exist. Sri Aurobindo says in chapter 1, contradictions are complements. Because the divine is infinite, it can't be expressed through any one form of perfection. It's not a finite perfection. It's an infinite perfection, and therefore it has to take infinite different forms. So we are ignorant of the fact that essentially, fundamentally, yourself and myself and all ourselves are one. That's the spiritual truth. We have a soul that's got an individual capacity to it, but fundamentally there's only one self. And if we didn't have the ignorance, if we only knew that we're all one, all the creativity that comes through variation would be lost. The fact that Darcy can hunt for, aspire for Elizabeth, the fact that when he leaves Lambton Inn, Lizzie can say, I'll never see him again, is because they're ignorant of their oneness. And that ignorance creates a creative situation that makes them both aspire to be more than they are. So in the purpose of the evolution, the fact that we are in the ego, the fact that we're feeling separate from everybody else, it's not the end of the story. The fact that that she tells Darcy, you're the last man on earth, and the fact that he leaves Lambton Inn and she thinks I'll never see him again, it's not the end of the story. We won't read the story if it ends at Hunsford or Lambton. But it's a necessary condition for Darcy to make the maximum effort for his progress, for Lizzie to make the maximum effort for her progress. So living in the ego, the ignorance of the ego, helps us develop more of our potential, which we wouldn't do if we were conscious of the oneness all along. The beauty of different people is, maybe we don't all feel as beautiful as the flowers are, but each of us is a flower in the making, a spiritual quality in the process of evolution. And why should we all be one flower when there's millions of types of flowers, millions of qualities of spiritual vibration to develop and manifest themselves? We want bouquets. We fill our bouquets with so many types of beautiful flowers. No? So the individual, the creation of the individual who feels separate, who feels different from everybody else, is an early stage in the evolution of the divine as millions of different spiritual qualities through each of us, through every human being, through every soul. Think about society. Every country has its own culture, has its own strengths and weaknesses. If you look back in history, you find that India had a profound contribution to the evolution of humanity even 2,000 years ago. Of course, we know about the zero and the Hindu numerals, which were used all over the world now. And there are so many things which we don't know about. And we know that even Christianity drew a lot of inspiration from the Upanishads. There's even stories that Christ came to India and lived here. Whatever the truth or not, the Greek were a famous civilization 2,300 years ago. Today it's a basket case. But the whole world is living based on the discoveries and developments of Greece 2,000, 3,000 years ago. And 200 years ago or 100 years ago, England was the famous empire, and we've had the Roman. Each society in time has contributed to the development of humanity. And there's no country that hasn't contributed, maybe more some than others, because the others are going to come much more later and they haven't finished their role. Or it's so far in the past, we have no record of it. Now, paper was first made in China a few thousand years ago. Paper money was made in China. The spoon, there's so many things. Who learned how to create milk into curd? Where'd the sweet potato come from, or the chili, this famous, very important thing. Every country, every culture has contributed. If we were all the same, we'd all be white. We'd all be white light. It'd all be white cloth, rather. It'd be very plain. So because the human potential is infinite, because it's divine, and we can't all develop everything all at once, the human spirit, the spirit, is evolving different qualities in different countries at different times and gradually sharing them and exchanging them. So something emerges in which, not that we're all looking the same or acting the same, but the whole human community is enriched by the truths that have been developed by so many different civilizations over so much time. So we're all richer for that diversity. This is the spiritual principle. I'm talking socially, but the same principle is there spiritually for the universe, because the riches that we're all are at our source is infinite. We each develop a part of it and represent it, and we come in a bouquet of flowers in which all the divine qualities can be represented in that bouquet, and it's something that exceeds what any individual or any one flower can give. This is the role of the ignorance as a temporary measure to allow us to develop exclusively a part. Each of us developing a part and then later discovering, well, I thought I was great, but actually what you have is much greater, and I want that, and I want to learn from you, and I want to benefit from that. And we gradually, as we evolve more, we become less insistent on what we know or what we have done, and more grateful for what everybody else has done, until we lose the ego and we enjoy the whole bouquet. But in the beginning, we each have to concentrate on something. We each have to develop something. We each have to become something and then give up the limitations of that exclusive concentration. He says, then, that the purpose of the ignorance in nature is a conscious, intentional self-absorption and self-forgetfulness for the joy of a progressive evolutionary self-discovery. Not just to recover what we've lost, but to manifest what's hidden. To manifest in life what is there now in potential, but can't express itself. So this ignorance has a purpose behind it. There is a goal. The goal is a progressive unfolding and an increasing delight of existence, and it gets better and better and better and better the further we go on. And if you read back in history to what life was like 200, 300, 500 years ago, you really can believe that things are getting better. Because even in the most prosperous countries, life was very backward, primitive, harsh by comparison with what we have today. No king 200 years ago lived as happily, comfortably as we do. If the king had a headache, all you could do is hit him on the head. If he had a toothache, you could knock out the tooth. If he wants to reach somebody who's 500 miles away, he has to send a messenger for him. No comparison with what the ordinary, every individual has access to today. He says the purpose of the self-absorption is not just for the delight of discovery, but he goes further and says the purpose is for the delight of discovery in its very opposite, in conditions that are its very opposite. This story is a wonder because in the beginning Darcy is so proud, so aloof, so superior that he could become so happy, so magnanimous, so humble, so generous. That's the delight of the story. The delight of the story is that up until this time, no Bennett girl has even had a proposal. If Jane had been married at 17 or 18, it'd be one thing. She's already 22. She's never had a proposal. There's real wondering whether any of the girls can get married at 50 pounds a year income. The wonder is that three of them are married in 1 year. And after the three get married in such a short time, especially after losing the entail, when they have nothing to offer, then the others getting married. For 25 years, Mr. Bennett was wondering about the marriage, hoping for a boy because otherwise they'll lose the property. They lost the property, and after all of that, the girls get married. The fact that on August 15th, the country celebrates independence every year. Why are we celebrating independence every year? Why do we celebrate and make a big deal of it? If we do make a big deal, maybe because there are sales now, I don't know at the time. But why does every country? Because for 800 years, this country was not independent. We celebrated in America because it happened in 1776. I don't know that Britain has an Independence Day. I don't think they have an Independence Day. Because at least for 1,000 years, they were independent. So we celebrate our independence because we know what it was like to be slaves. We know what it was like to be ruled by somebody else. It's the condition of the very opposite. When Barack Obama became elected as President of the United States, the whole world celebrated and congratulated, oh, a black man has become president of the most powerful country in the world. Became president of a country in which there used to be slavery 150 years ago. What's the big deal? Who cares what color his skin is, whether it's black or brown or yellow or red or whatever it is? Why are you making a fuss? Because this was the man who was considered not human. These were the people who in this country, at least many people, not everybody, considered not human. And now they make him their president. That's really remarkable. So it's when it happens in the conditions of the very opposite that it creates a greater wonder for us that Darcy could be humble. We're not surprised that Bingley can be soft and humble. But Darcy could be humble. That's really amazing for us. If a man says, I have fallen in love and married, and the last 5 years of my life with this woman have been the happiest of my life, we can say it's very nice. Very nice. A lot of people marry, and some people are lucky enough to feel that it's something very special. But if he tells you, I met this woman when I was 90 years old, and the last 5 years have been the most wonderful years of my life, and I think only now I'm living. Somehow this says something different to us. Because he lived for 90 years and didn't have this happiness, the fact that even at 90 you can have this happiness. Well, body may grow older, but the heart doesn't. Creates a new reality. It gives us a new glimpse. It's never too late. The greatest wonder, the greatest miracle can come at any time, in any form, in the least expected thing. Behind the ignorance is an infinite potential hiding, concealing itself. So, this is the purpose of the ignorance. To manifest an infinite delight, not just a static delight, but an ever-changing, unfolding, and growing delight that is not limited to anything at any time. And as we said, ignorance comes with the plane of mind, and the fundamental point at which ignorance is introduced is when mind gets cut off from the spirit, from its oneness with the divine and its oneness with everything else. And he says, this happens as we come down from supermind to overmind. There's a veil. In supermind, we have the total vision of everything, and everything is one. We see everything, but we also know it's one. We see the multiplicity, but we also know it's one. In overmind, we see the multiplicity, but there's a veil so that the fact that everything is one is getting behind. It's not completely hidden, but it's behind. In mind, the veil becomes opaque and we can't see the truth. We can't see the fundamental reality of our existence anymore. I think of it like a one-way mirror. You know, they use one-way mirrors in the police. They interrogate the, you know what a one-way mirror is? You know what it is. If you have two rooms and there's a mirror on the wall separating the rooms, on one side of the mirror, you look and you see your own reflection because it's a mirror. But on the other side of the mirror, you see through. It's only a glass. They use it in psychology and in criminology. They use it when they're interrogating people. Somebody's in the room talking to the person. Somebody's outside the room looking in. The person in the room sees only a reflection in the mirror, but the person on the other side can see them. They do it in psychology for experiments and all. So our mind is like a one-way mirror. When we look in the mind, we see only ourselves. We don't see the divine. But when the divine looks through the mirror, he sees everything. The divine sees everything. So we are ignorant. Brahman is not ignorant. Brahman sees all through the mirror, through the glass. We keep seeing only our own reflection and think there's nothing else there but ourselves. So, if our ignorance is the result of this veil that cuts us off, the obvious way is for us to reverse the ignorance to get to the knowledge. Reverse the exclusive concentration. If our exclusive concentration in the ignorance is because Darcy thinks he's important and Lizzie is tolerable, he feels superior, then he must come to realize the real value in Lizzie and also realize his own limitations that make him feel humble. He has to reverse that exclusive concentration and begin to see the divine in her and also to see the ignorance in himself, which he does. When Lizzie reads his letter at Hunsford, she has the same thing. All along she thinks she sees clearly. That man is arrogant, mean, selfish. He's the last man on earth. He's done so many mean things to Wickham. He spoiled Jane's happiness and all. After reading his letter, she realizes it's not Darcy who spoiled Jane's happiness. It's our whole family, the way we've been acting. It's not Darcy who ruined Wickham's life. It's Wickham who almost ruined Georgiana's life and has been unfairly scandalizing Darcy. It's not Darcy who's been acting absurdly. It's me, Elizabeth Bennet, who believed my own point of view and thought his point of view is totally wrong. So when Darcy's standing there staring at her at the dance and admiring her, she thinks he's making fun of her. He's despising her. So to reverse the ignorance is to realize the ignorance of our position and to try to discover the truth of other people's position. That's why Appa constantly talks about take the other man's point of view. We reverse the process that got us to this exclusive concentration. My exclusive concentration is to think I'm important, my life is important, what I get is important. If somebody else gets, I feel sorry because they got more and now I'm less important, or they must be special and I'm not special. It's their achievement, it's my failure. To reverse that and recognize anybody getting something is something for me, is good for me. That's called goodwill, to be happy whenever anybody gets something. I feel happy when people give me things, to reverse that self-absorption is to feel happy when I give things to other people and feel the joy of that happiness and know I'm giving to my quieter self. These are things we know. I feel happy when I win an argument. Ah, you see, I was right, they were wrong. To reverse it is to feel happy when there is no argument, when we can be harmonious with the other person, when we can eliminate the capacity for argument, even when the other person has the opposite point of view. Spiritually, if we want to come out of our ignorance, he tells us, we concentrate not on the surface, because our ignorance is this, we're self-absorbed in the surface ego, we're self-absorbed in the moment. To come out of the ignorance, we go deep within and try to concentrate on our immortal being. Or we concentrate on Mother, who is the immortal, the mind. We become aware of the truth of our existence inside. But in the tradition, when we discover the truth inside, we reject the outside. It becomes another form of exclusive concentration. Instead of exclusively concentrating on the stream, I exclusively concentrate on the ocean. And I say, the stream is an illusion. And he says, the stream is not an illusion. It's an expression of the ocean. Therefore, we can rise up to the supermind, which can see the stream is real, the ocean is real, the stream is an expression of the ocean. And that is a supramental, an integral consciousness. And the final reversal is when we come down into the stream, when we come on the stream and we ride on the stream, but all the time we're still conscious of the ocean. We live in the moment, but we're conscious of the infinity of the... We live on the surface, we act on the surface, but we're conscious of the infinity behind. And that is life becomes divine life. It's a reversal of this self-absorption. In the tradition, they reversed the self-absorption by going from the ego to moksha. So they went from one ignorance to another ignorance. That ignorance may look to be very respectable by comparison, but it's not why the divine created the universe. If he wanted everybody to be in moksha, we need not have created a universe and gone through thousands of births. That's where we started from. We simply end up going back to where we started from. That's not the plan. The divine plan is we create something that creates greater ecstasy and adventure and wonder at every moment, because we manifest what is our potential. Appa speaks of many ways in which we can reverse the exclusive concentration, and you know them all. At the end of almost every session, I repeat the same list, because there's only one right answer to the exam question. Whatever the question is, there's a right answer. In this case, there's only one question. How do we come out of the ignorance? And there's more than one answer. There are many ways to come out, but ultimately it's all one answer. So I've been mentioning some of those each time. One of the very interesting ways is what Appa calls consciousness responsibility. That's actually a phrase he created. I've never read it anywhere else. says to progress out of the ignorance is to take consciousness responsibility. Consciousness responsibility means we take responsibility for something that we normally consider is not our responsibility. Or we take responsibility for something that we think is not even in our power to be responsible for. And yet we find when we do that, that we have a power we didn't know we had. We can say in the story that when Lydia eloped, Mr. Bennett and Mr. Gardner tried to find Wickham and Lydia. They couldn't do it. Darcy went to London, hunted for weeks, found them, negotiated with his not arch rival, his arch enemy, Wickham, saved the life of this girl who was quite disgusting to him by her poor, her behavior, low behavior, went to Cheapside, a place where he looked down and he taunted Bingley, "You can't afford to marry some Jane because she has relatives in Cheapside." He goes to the gardener's house, befriends them, and not only says, "I've arranged for the marriage," but he says, I will pay off Wickham's debts and pay for this marriage to happen." And Mr. Gardner says, no, we can't allow that to happen. You are not responsible for any of this. If the family must pay, if Mr. Bennett can't pay, I will pay. I will take the responsibility." And Darcy says, "No, it's my responsibility." And then he comes up with this explanation. How is it your responsibility? Well, I don't know if he tells Mr. Bennett, but his argument is, I was the one who knew what Wickham was. I was the only one who really knew what Wickham was. He tried to elope with Georgiana, and I didn't want to tell the world because I didn't want to expose Georgiana. And everybody has suffered because of that, and therefore I am responsible, and I must pay. Well, it's a very tenuous argument. Does he have a right to tell the world about what Georgiana almost did if it's going to ruin Georgiana's reputation? He has a responsibility to her. The truth of the matter is he did tell Lizzie about Wickham. In spite of his telling Lizzie about Wickham, Lizzie didn't tell Mr. Bennett about Wickham, and so if he had any responsibility to the Bennett family, he's already discharged it by disclosing the truth of Wickham, that which was itself a great secret that he's never told anybody. The only people who know that Wickham tried to elope with Georgiana is Georgiana and Wickham, and Mrs. Young, of course, the governess, and Darcy and Fitzwilliam, who's his god, she's his god, Georgiana's, he's a godfather to her. They're the only five of them. He has disclosed a secret that for the last few years he's not told any other person. Even Lady Catherine doesn't know, and she's a close relation. He goes out of his way to tell her this deep family secret. If he had any responsibility, he has discharged it at that point. But he says, no, I am responsible. He took consciousness responsibility for people who were outside of his immediate family and outside of his control. To say he's responsible for Wickham is ridiculous. Wickham won't do anything he says. Nobody can be responsible for Lydia, especially if her parents can't be responsible. Nobody can control this girl. She's totally irresponsible. He says, no, my responsibility doesn't end with myself or even with my sister. It extends out. And he also says, My responsibility is not just in the moment. My responsibility goes back to the fact that a few years ago, Wickham tried to elope with my sister, and I have not acted after that in a way that's completely consistent. I have acted in the moment. I wanted to keep quiet. So, you see the logic of this? We say the exclusive concentration is we concentrate on the surface, we ignore the oneness of our relation with everybody else, and we concentrate in the moment. To take consciousness responsibility is to be able to accept responsibility over time. The responsible person is not just a person who does the right thing at the moment. The responsible person accepts continuing responsibility from beginning to end for the outcome regardless of the circumstances. That's the definition of responsible, to say, I locked the door today, so I've done my duty. What about yesterday? What about tomorrow? If you're the watchman, you must guard the gate every night, otherwise you're not responsible. No, I only forgot once in 3 days. That's responsibility requires consistency over time, means we can't be absorbed in the moment and just be it for a minute. We have to be consistent over time. And consciousness responsibility means to be responsible not only for ourselves, but to widen the net and reach of that consciousness further and further. And Sri Aurobindo says, if there's an Indian devotee today who really in the depths of his heart wants to solve the Kashmir problem, you have the power to do that. It must be a felt emotion and a deep aspiration. The principle is the deeper, the wider the net we can concentrate on, the deeper we go into our infinite being. The more we leave the surface, the more we go to our own depths. Appa has written, and I think we have mentioned earlier, the story of Dr. Thorne. It's the story by Trollope. Dr. Thorne has an older brother, Henry. Maybe it's a younger brother, I'm not sure. But he's a bad man. He's an irresponsible rogue. He seduces a young woman named Mary from the working class. Thorne is from an old family that can trace its heritage back 800 years. But they have lost their property. There's another branch of the family, the Ullathornes, that are still wealthy and respectable, but this branch, the father and the son, have no property. They have to work. And that's why Thorne became a physician, and he works hard, and he makes a very modest living. He's respectable because he's intelligent, and he's a gentleman, and he's educated, but there's no status for him. But they're of an old family that can trace back 800 years. Mary is from a working class family. Her brother, Roger, is a bricklayer. He's a mason. Henry seduces Mary, and I believe he gave her some drug that disabled her, and she becomes pregnant. How far it was her fault or not, she's a good girl. Whether it was completely due to the drug or not, she was taken in because this Henry is of an educated, higher family, and she was enamored of his attentions, and he promised to marry her. Once she became pregnant, he's a rogue. He simply laughed and said, I want nothing to do with you. Roger, her brother, who's the mason, strong physical worker, he went to Henry's house, and when Henry and demanded of Henry, and when Henry laughed at him, Roger just hit him and killed him. Is he so strong? And Roger was in prison for murder and sentenced to Mary now has a child. There's another man in the town, a hardware merchant, who loves Mary, who has always loved Mary, who had tried proposing to her. Now he comes and says, I'm willing to move with you to Canada, from England to Canada, and start a new life. But you have to give up the child. So how can Mary give up the child, and what will she do with the child? There's nobody to take care of the child. So Dr. Thorne comes to Mary and says, I will take the child. If there's one person in the story who's not responsible for anything, it was Dr. Thorne. It's the brother who he has already broken with long ago, because the brother's a bad man. He totally disapproves of him. He has nothing to do with Mary, but he says, I will take the child and raise her as her uncle. And Mary agrees. The child's also named Mary, and the mother goes with the hardware merchant to Canada and just lives after that. But he's not satisfied. Dr. Thorne goes to the authorities, hires a lawyer to get Roger out of prison. He says, after all, the man didn't intend to commit murder. He was furious, and my brother provoked him, and there was good cause for that provocation. At most, you can call it accidental murder. And got him out of prison after 6 months. Not uncalled for. And for him to spend money, he was not a rich man to have a lot of money. Roger then became much more successful in life. He became a big contractor, and he ultimately earned hundreds of thousands of pounds, became a very wealthy man. Thorne raises Mary as his niece. Mary doesn't know anything about her origins. She knows he's the uncle. She thinks her parents died when she was young. With such an affection, he has raised her, educated her. She's more than a daughter to him, and he's more than a father to her. They are blissfully happy together. Thorne is the advisor to Mr. Gresham, who's a very wealthy farmer, not a state owner. And Mary is introduced into the house of the Greshams and is educated there and becomes friends with all the Gresham children. And Frank Gresham, the heir to the Greshams, falls in love with her and wants to marry her. And Frank's mother, who's an aristocrat, she's a titled lady, is terrified of this, especially because she knows that Mary is actually the illegitimate daughter of a working class girl and has no money. By this time, the Greshams are in debt. They have spent their money. They have half of their estate has been pledged to Roger, who's now got a title as sir, and has become so wealthy that he actually owns half of the Gresham property. Roger doesn't know that he has a niece. And Gresham doesn't know that Mary is Roger's niece either. Nobody knows except this. So Thorne raises her, keeps it a secret, has sacrificed everything for the happiness of this girl. When Frank proposes to Mary, his parents protest, especially his mother, and disgraces Mary and refuses to allow her to come to the house, embarrasses her in front of the whole community. And then Mary finds out the truth about her own birth. Thorne happens to also be the executor for Roger, who has been in charge of Roger's estate. Roger dies, leaving his property to his son, Lewis. But if Lewis dies, Thorne is the only one in the world who knows that property will go to Mary. He takes care of Lewis, who's an alcoholic and very sickly and a very obnoxious personality, but does everything he can to save the life of Lewis, even though he knows if Lewis dies, Mary will inherit this huge fortune. Nobody else knows. Lewis doesn't know. Mary doesn't know. The Greshams don't know. Frank's mother doesn't know. And finally, the end of the story, Lewis and Frank doesn't know, but he loves Mary and wants to marry her anyway, even if he has to become a farmer. And finally, at the end of the story, Lewis dies and Mary inherits this property. And she marries Frank, and the mother who was opposing her, and very meanly for the sake of her family and her estate, finds out that this girl, Mary, who she said should not come to the house, actually owns half their property. They are deeply in debt to Mary, and without her, they may have to sell the rest. That she's twice as wealthy as they ever were. And she, against the advice of her own lawyers, pays off all the debts. Actually, it's the father who owes the money to her. Instead of keeping that debt, she writes off the debt and gives the estate back to the father without any hindrance. And she has half of the wealth, and the parents have the half, which will go to Frank in any case. And then she's not finished there. Through Frank, she has met a wealthy lady named Miss Dunstable. And at the age when her father, when Dr. Thorne is past 50, Miss Dunstable's very wealthy also. He's got more money than even Roger had. He's got £300,000 or £400,000. And everybody is proposing to Miss Dunstable, even people from the aristocracy. Earls are doing it, people, because everybody wants the money. She doesn't want to marry anybody who's after her money. Mary introduces Dr. Thorne, and she understands that this is the only man who would never marry her for her money. And though he has nothing, he's living in a small house and everything, this is the man I will marry, and she marries him. So this is a story about a man who took consciousness responsibility for something that was not his responsibility at all. He doesn't know Mary, this woman. He didn't know Roger. He has no responsibility for what Henry did. But he takes responsibility for everything. He wants to preserve the good name of his family by doing the right thing. Even when he's the executor of Roger's will, he refuses to think of any possible benefit for himself. He feels the responsibility to save Lewis's life and bends over backwards to do it. He feels the responsibility to help the Greshams without ever claiming anything. And he raises this girl. One, he has such a fulfilling relationship with her. She's more than a daughter to him. She more than adores him and loves him. He elevates the girl from being a penniless, illegitimate child to becoming the future heir of the Gresham estate, whose mother, and marrying into a family where they're titled aristocrats. And further, he rises, marrying a woman worth twice as much as Roger was, or which Mary and the Greshams are. All of this without doing a single thing for himself. Because he took consciousness responsibility. Is it a story? It's a nice story. It's an inspiring. Is it a story? Or is there a truth here? The truth here is the kernel of this chapter. The truth is, when we take consciousness responsibility, which sounds, oh, it's very frightening. Oh, what a sacrifice. Oh, that man is a saint. The truth is, when we take consciousness responsibility, we are moving to the truth. The truth is, we are responsible. We are one. And the more we extend that, the closer we come to the truth of our own existence. And the more we come to the truth of our own existence, the more the divinity in our life manifests. It's not a chance. It's not just a reward. It's the truth. Being conscious responsible is evolving from ignorance to knowledge. That's why Mother said she feels responsible for every soul that she's ever seen. Because she's divine, she's infinite. And when you're infinite, you know that all souls are part of you. And she had that power. She did have that power to bless so many thousands and thousands of people because she was in touch. She knew herself at that level. So the more we take consciousness responsibility, the more we acquire the power and the joy and the knowledge, which is really ours behind, which we're lost in the self-absorption, the exclusive concentration. So consciousness responsibility reverses the ignorance and brings the knowledge. It brings divinity into our life. That's a story. Appa wrote a short essay on this a few days ago, and he sent it to Chandrasekharan. And Chandrasekharan wrote back this morning, I think, giving two stories that he knows are not stories. They're real. They're not literary stories. They're real in the lives of people he knows, which illustrate the same principle. One of them he talks about, a man and a woman died leaving 6 children. They left them in poverty. The children were selfish. So there was a disharmony. They had nothing, and they had, apart from that, they had disharmony. Only thing is, the last son was a good, sweet boy who was very generous, who even when he had hardly anything, he would help anyone. He would help all his relatives. He would help anyone who needed it. The rest of the family completely ignored him, never did anything for him, but even then, he got a job in a big company, and whatever he had, he would share with the rest of the family, even though none of them were deserving in the normal sense. After some time, 10 other employees of that company decided to leave the company and start their own company. And they invited him to come along. And he joined that company, and today that company is 150 crores. And he's one of the 10 owners of the company. A man who started with nothing, but consciousness responsibility to the maximum extent, was given without his seeking it what he was given. The other story was about a rich man who had hundreds of acres. The father died. The son took responsibility. There were 4 or 5 unmarried sisters. There was a brother and so many cousins. He took responsibility for the whole family. He was not a good manager. He was not an experienced, clever person. And gradually over time, he had to sell more and more of the property to support all of these people. Eventually, he sold even the family house. He went into poverty and had 0 income. At that time, all his relatives deserted him, and nobody was willing to do anything. He became old and sickly. He had a son who was raised with these attitudes of responsibility. The son got a good job. He took responsibility for the parents. He got married. He married a good girl. The girl and the boy both felt they should not abandon his parents. They should do whatever is necessary. The same spirit with which the parents had acted in their generation when they had something. They were not wealthy. They had just a little money, but whatever they had, they extended for the boy's parents. At one time, a relative came to them needing some money to start a business. They had only a few thousands of rupees. The son and the wife took their few thousands of rupees and invested it in a small company to get 50% of the share. And today that company is worth 50 crores. So this principle of consciousness responsibility is not just a good thing. It's not just a high ideal. It is a way for us to reverse the ignorance. It's a way for us to come out of this exclusive concentration. It's a way for us to discover the infinite potential within us. Would anyone like to, any questions or comments or anything you'd like to share, or anybody from any of the other centers also? Mike, is there, so others can hear you? Is there a mic? Or it's here. Come here, Mom. Come here. So it'll go on the system.
The real story of the center itself was when we asked the second new building for the center, somebody offered the whole amount of the equal responsibility to pay the money. But in the first installment itself, he was removed from the, he got out of the picture. But we have promised the builder and everything is without one single pipe. How we got to build this center? It's not me, but the devotees around me took the conscious responsibility. Because it's smaller, they are doing a government service, because they are not business people around us. Small detail, small money, but everybody took that answer possibly. And the money flowing. And that is finally, now we are seeing the building. Finally, the success. And now, because of that conscious responsibility, the building for itself grows. After completing the building, now the 2 years, we are completing the 2 years, we never ask anybody to give a fine for the building fund, but it flow. Because only because of the faith and conscious responsibility, now we are the building set.
Great. Great. Wonderful. Anyone else?
For the 3 or 4 months, we are talking about the ignorance. I saw the title, Exclusive Concentration of Consciousness, that we can understand. But the ignorance, where we have exclusive concentration? But Gary explained very clearly, always we are concentrating on our ignorance. We are not conscious. We are always unconscious. and we are always a exclusive concentration in that ignorance. When I explain the title, what is this exclusive concentration, that word struck me. But he explained in very clear manner and how we are in the ignorance, how we have to overcome the ignorance, how mind is seeing the path and how we have to see the goal. And always we have the opportunities beforehand. We are not seeing the opportunities through because of our ignorance. We are seeing it as a problem. We have done. In the case of Sandar, when he started talking about the conscious responsibility, everybody took the conscious responsibility. We know what is consciousness responsibility, but that is what we have to do in every day and in every minute of our life. That is what I want to say. And it is a very good session. And I am thanking you specially to Mr. Gary and all the devotees, and special thanks to every devotees. I am closing this session.